When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and Final Rise. On this episode of the show, we take a walk through the woods with a Wisconsin County Forester, Mike Amon. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 179. All right, welcome back to the Birdshot Podcast, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. We have an excellent show coming up for you with my friend Mike Amon, Wisconsin County Forester, and we'll get to that very soon. But first, thank you to the Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast. A quick reminder, this month's giveaway includes a gift basket of sorts, Onyx Elite subscription card, a bumper and reusable solo cup from Yukonuba, a fresh duplicate copy of Shooting Sportsman, addressed to yours truly, and a few other things from Pioneers Grouse Camp and Birdshot Podcast. That's a June giveaway. We'll be announcing that winner probably on the next episode. You could be eligible for all monthly Patreon giveaways by signing up at patreon.com/birdshot. You can sign up for as few as $5 a month. I will send you some Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you, and you will be eligible for those giveaways and other discounts like the ones we've got for Gumleaf Boots and Upland Institute. All patrons of the Birdshot Podcast are eligible for those discounts. So thanks for considering that. And next up, a reminder, we are still running the gun fitting giveaway with Del Whitman. That is going to go through July 14th. So if you're listening to this before July 14th and you are interested in a gun fitting with Del Whitman, which means you will have to get to Traverse City, Michigan, all you have to do is send me an email, nick@birdshotpodcast.com, put gun fit or fitting in the subject line. Let me know you are interested, and we are accepting all entries through July 14th for that. For more details, you can check out the episode we just did with Del Whitman, which is episode number 177 of the Birdshot Podcast. And don't forget, anybody out there listening can always save 20% on their next Onyx Hunt subscription using the promo code BSP20. That's BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. Onyx, of course, being an invaluable tool in my upland bird hunting pursuits, without a doubt. It's where I take and apply a lot of the things that I learn from people like our guest today, Mike Amon. Over the years, I've gotten to know Mike. He has shared a lot of knowledge and information with me about forestry, grouse and woodcock habitat, cover, the way he looks at and analyzes forest, timber stands, regeneration, all those sorts of things that I've become more and more interested in as a grouse and woodcock hunter. And I will say, based on past episodes we've done, around this topic. I believe the interest level is quite high among listeners, so I don't think the episode needs a whole lot of setup beyond that. But I will say that the more I have learned about forest management, forestry, and the forest I hunt grouse and woodcock in, while it has made me a better hunter in many ways, it has also, and perhaps more importantly, really increased the enjoyment level and the satisfaction I get out of my hunts. And I'm pretty confident you will pull something out of this conversation with Mike that we have on the show today. We talk about a lot of stuff. We catch up a bit. We talk about turkey hunting in the North Woods and the Big Woods, as Mike did a lot of that this spring, and he's been one of my turkey hunting mentors. He was on the first turkey hunt I ever went on a few years ago, and he's definitely somebody I have leaned on as I have explored that in recent years. But even more so, Mike has been a go-to resource for me when it comes to grouse and woodcock habitat and looking through the trees, seeing the forest, so to speak, deepening my understanding of what components make up the forest, aka good grouse and woodcock habitat, how to find it, how to hunt it, and how it's created and sustainably managed. So, as you will soon find out, getting to know your county forester, especially if they are a grouse hunter, can be extremely beneficial in many ways. And without further ado, let's welcome into the conversation and onto the Birdshot Podcast, Wisconsin County Forester Mike Amon. Welcome to the Birdshot Podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Let's get right down to business. What was the forester doing today? Were you in the woods today, Mike?
Actually, I was not quite in the woods. I was actually in the Barrens within the county forest system. I met with the DNR wildlife guy and one of my coworkers, and we're developing these new Barrens and maintaining existing Barrens for sharptails and providing sort of a unique system within the county forest system. So we were out in the Barrens talking about the work that needs to get done and what's working, what isn't, and just, you know, a lot of scheduling to talk about, you know, site maintenance, burning, and road construction to kind of make these properties and these habitats, you know, as functional and as easy to maintain as possible. So yeah, it was fun. We have two Barrens that we have on the property, and one's new and one's just getting opened up completely. So we were talking Barrens habitat.
Excellent. Well, I think I might have a tendency to sort of move on and sort of do some more housekeeping stuff, but since we sort of dove in there and we're talking Barrens habitat, I'll take care of the intro and the intro to the show. Let's dive in a little deeper here. What is Barrens habitat, Mike?
Yeah, Barrens is basically this mix of grass, shrubs, and trees. And historically, I work in Bayfield County. The Northwest Sands is a few million acres. It's this sandy outwash plain that extends from, you know, in across northwest Wisconsin. And within that, historically, there was a lot of fire. And so with that sandy soil, droughty soil, and just the natural system was, it burned a lot. So historically, the forest I worked on wasn't forest at all. It was mostly open brush. And so obviously with fire suppression and just land use changes, we have grown trees there instead of maintained wildfire. So Barrens is an open landscape. And historically, we had a whole lot more of it where I work and in this part of the state. And so there's a lot of species that are associated with Barrens that historically were here that are in tough shape, sharp-tailed grouse included, but a number of other species, upland sandpiper, to name one of a lot of them that, you know, we just don't have many of those birds left or those species left. So we're on the county forest trying to maintain some of these Barrens. So it's sort of this blended mix of grass, lands, shrubs, and trees.
Yeah, very cool. Something that I've talked about a little bit here on the podcast over the years, and I've gotten a lot more exposure to it, spending more time in northwest Wisconsin. We've got the family cabin over there, and I was pretty well unaware of what Barrens habitat was and some of the species that inhabit that, but now I'm quite familiar, have spent some time walking that stuff. Very interesting, especially as it is sort of scattered about this area of the state that you primarily think of just totally forested, you know, if it's public land or not, you know, a lot of forest coverage in that part of the state. But again, with that bit of historical perspective, you get the understanding the relationship the landscape had with fire and what these open areas can look like. Now, it's interesting because this conversation that we'll get into a little bit today, you being a county forester,
How does a baron's relationship work with being a county forester, in that obviously one of your objectives is to grow marketable products, trees, timber for sale for revenue? We can talk about some of the dynamics, but how does that relationship with the barons and what you do as a county forester, how do those dynamics play out?
Yeah, it's a little kind of an unnatural connection, because my job is to grow trees, and now here we are creating areas where there are very few trees, and so how do those things go together? So I think it's, over time, hopefully we're getting better at sort of managing holistically the entire system and recognizing that there's these species that aren't present, and we have a lot of ownership in this historic Barrens area. So I think it's educating the public, educating our forestry committee, and seeing where we can provide opportunity to provide these open areas. And it's a fraction of the total. I mean, the county forest is 170,000 acres is what I'm trying to say. So we're going to try and provide 2,000 acres of permanent open barrens. So it's a very small percentage of the total.
Yeah.
And the good thing about these species that utilize barrens, they will also use young forests. So we can provide a lot of working timberlands adjacent to these permanent cores. And so by having a small, relatively small 1,000-acre opening, can provide a lot of habitat. And then as you have strategic management around it called rolling barrens, you can still have productive timberlands still as a part of the system. Because large clear cuts, young forests, there's a lot of species that interact with the barrens habitat, and they use young forests, Kirkland warbler and golden-winged warbler. And so there's a lot of species that will kind of interface with young working forests and the barrens habitat. So I think being strategic about where we open up these acres, meanwhile still providing a lot of high productive, working forests. So they do work together. I think it's just having that conversation, being open-minded to where it makes sense to do these barrens habitats. And that's where we're kind of fitting into the DNR. And they have a plan to kind of connect these landscapes across the Northwest Sands. And, some of these areas have been identified as critical areas to create these new barrens habitats. So I think we can have working forest lands and provide some a unique opportunity for these barren species.
Yeah, the rolling barrens concept is, I'm only familiar with that based on some information that you shared with me a couple of years as I was kind of learning more about it. But a very interesting creative way. And I think it highlights a couple things here. One of them being this long-term outlook that you as a forester have for the landscape. And this is something that I wanted to mention this right away. You recently were on a podcast. What is that? It's the Wisconsin BHA podcast. You remember what the name of it is?
I think it's like the Wisconsin BHA report
or something. Yeah. So great podcast. Folks can check that out. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes. I listened to it. And Mike and I've known Mike for a handful of years now. We've hunted together. And this is kind of funny, Mike, because I've thought about interviewing you often enough because of the interesting conversations we have over the years. But then it's, I kind of like to keep some of my secrets, now that I'm exposing you to the audience of the Birdshot podcast, your mailbox might be full and you might not have as much time for me and my questions, Mike.
Yeah. Well, I have a non-disclosure agreement with Nick on any and all of this intel that I may or may not know. So I think your secret's safe with me.
Yeah. But anyways, in that podcast, you guys dove deep into really the county forests and talked a lot about some of the forestry topics and ideas that we'll get into here. But again, that long-term outlook, which I think as an upland bird hunter, or, I think in some ways as rough grouse and woodcock hunters, if you do it long enough and you get in tune with forestry practices and how that benefits and sustains hunting, you have maybe a longer term outlook than some hunters or some other categories of hunters. But again, we're talking 10 years, the 10 years is a number that comes to mind, but you're looking at things like on a 40-year rotation, growing trees, knowing that you can't cut them for 40 years. Talk a little bit about how you analyze the landscape through that long of a timeline, even though historically speaking, it's a pretty short window of time, but to me and you and the pace of everyday life, it seems like an eternity.
Excellent point. Yeah. Long-term thinking is not necessarily how humans are wired. It's like everything gets faster and faster these days. Like, what can you do for me right now?
Yep.
And so then it's like, okay, how do we look into, like, the rolling barrens part won't be fully implemented until like 2080. I mean, like the amount of moving parts we are trying to plan for to set up this rolling barrens to be successful is super complicated and takes patience and a lot of planning. And, you know, being a long-term landowner, I mean, we are in a position, fortunately, where we can take the time to look into the future. And even us, you know, as we're regenerating stands, it's like, how's it doing right now? And when do we need to, what do we need to do to go in to make sure that it's going to, you know, be, you know, and, you know, the stocking's going to be in good shape and we're going to have trees there to harvest into the future. But I think part of it is just the longer I'm in this world and the longer that I get the stuff I look at every day is just sort of 50-year rotations, thinnings every 10 or 15 years. So I think you kind of get in the world of we're just going to – we've owned this land for 80 or 90 years already, and it's – you know, the data came to me as rotation ages and the forest has been inventoried. And so I think it's just routine for me to look at and say, all right, we just had a timber sale. Schedule that for 2085. And, you know, that's just sort of the world I live in, or, you know, next thing is 2050. And so I think it's, you know, it's nice because it is, if you try and manage timber for, you know, immediate, you know, revenue, it's all going to be gone and be like, okay, we cashed out, now what? And so I think having the county forest system and some of these public lands that, you know, have long-term ownership, have 20-year management plans that are continually renewed, it sort of, it sets you up for long-term thinking. But, patience is tough, even when you're sort of assessing what's working and what's not. And just even the rolling barrens concept hasn't really been done yet. So we don't even know the best way to implement the rolling barrens. And I mean, that's what we were talking about today. Do we do a pie shape? Do we, you know, the size of the cuts, you know, locations within the zones? It's a lot of theoretical, like what's going to work, what isn't. And the nice thing is we can pivot and move and adapt as we go, but it's you want things to occur so you can sort of make the informed decision, and other times it just takes so long to figure out what is working that it's sort of this blend of short term and long term, and it's definitely not the nature of humans, but I think in the system of forestry, fortunately, we've kind of set it up to be a little bit easier to do that.
Yeah, that's cool. And again, I mean, on the other hand, the best you can do essentially is make a long-term plan and then adjust and adapt as you move. I mean, that's really all we can do, and that's how you at least you've got an objective, something you're working towards, and as new information comes, you take that in and you alter your decision making as necessary.
Yeah, and I, just to quickly add, we're doing even internally, but we're doing some investments now to just get baseline data and just and know that we won't look at that stuff for 5 years or 10 years. You know, forest growth, forest composition, harvest success, objectives, measuring the young forest development. A lot of this stuff takes, like I said, a lot of patience, but we're setting up and doing investments, and you know, it's going to take a while to realize that. But I think some of this stuff, the best time to do it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So better late than never. But you know, I think at least on the forest I work at, we're sort of like patient about making investments strategically to kind of pay off into the future. And I think that's important to kind of keep making sure you're doing as good a management as possible.
Yeah, very cool. Well, we're gonna come back to probably some forestry stuff and maybe some bearings conversation. But at this point, I would like to let's get a little up to speed on Mike. You grew up in southern Wisconsin, right?
I did. Yeah, the Madison area. Yep.
Madison area, and early exposure to the outdoors. You've been hunting and fishing for a long time.
Yeah, my dad was a big hunter. Is a big hunter, and we grew up tagging along with dad, squirrel hunting and scouting turkeys and chopping. Yep. He loves to put up firewood. So we, I grew up going out on mostly private land, some public land, but he was a big, he brought the three boys into the woods and we all took to it. So we just grew up doing all of it. As long as I can remember, we were out in the woods tagging along with dad.
How did the forestry thing come about? Is that something you were chopping firewood one day and decided you're going to be a forester?
No, I was sort of aimless and lacked ambition as a kid. I think my parents were a little worried about, what are you going to do, Mike? And, I kind of liked being outside. You know, I started with the basics, which in hindsight, I'm so glad I did. And, you know, finance or medical or, you know, just like, what are all these things? Okay, you got to get a high-paying job or just you got to, you know, get after it. And I'm thinking, man, I like being outside. In high school, I took an environmental studies class, and that really was like, kind of opened my eyes to natural resources. And my dad worked for the DNR. He worked in natural resources. So I think I had a good foundation of like just natural resource management and being exposed to that. And then like I said, that class in high school, I sort of resonated with it and said, you know, let's not overcomplicate this. I think I want to work outside in the natural resources. So initially when I went to school, I was thinking of maybe wildlife or forestry. And I took my first forestry class, and I just fell in love with forestry and never looked back.
Very cool. And so we don't need to necessarily go through every turn and twist, but how did that path into forestry and eventually led you from southern Wisconsin and you wound up in the northern portion of Wisconsin?
Yeah, I was sitting in a forestry class at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the professor said something about a county forest. I had never heard of county forest in my life, and I'm thinking, Vilas County Forest, what does that mean? And it, you know, as a scenario or whatever he was describing. And I it stuck with me. I don't even think I looked into it. But as I was getting close to graduation, I started looking around for internships and what it was, and county forest. I saw internships for county forest. So I said, well, by then my parents had bought some property up by Minocqua. So we were spending a lot of time in northern Wisconsin, and just really, I mean, who doesn't love going to northern Wisconsin, especially if you're from the southern part of the state? Yeah. So I was like, well, shoot, county forest, internship, northern Wisconsin, I'll give it a shot. And it was everything I'd hoped it to be. And just large forest, continuous forest. It was just nice to be in the big woods, you know, the North Woods. We spent a lot of time deer hunting and rough grouse hunting in northern Wisconsin. So now I get a job and I can live and work in northern Wisconsin. It was great.
Yeah, very cool. And how long have you been with Bayfield County now?
19 years already. Jesus.
19 just, years, wow.
Yeah, I worked a little bit. I was an intern in Vilas County, which is northern Wisconsin. Then I worked for a year and a half in Burnett County, which is northwest Wisconsin. And then I've been here ever since and love it up here. I mean, Lake Superior, Shawamigan Bay, public land. It's going to be hard to... I'm not planning on leaving, I'll tell you that.
Well, you're preaching to the choir, as the listeners will know. Growing up here in Duluth, it's, you know, a lot of similarities, and we're not really that far apart geographically anyways, but it's a great place to be on a great lake for sure. So yeah, almost two decades, man. You've seen a couple grouse covers turn over, haven't you?
Come and go. Yeah. Oh, I mean, geez, again, just it's been so great. I've set up timber sales, watched them get cut, and have hunted them, and then, you know, they're starting to age out, and then the next one. It's been awesome, and it's really modified my management and how I set up timber sales as an avid grouse hunter, just in terms of retention patches and conifer retention and drumming logs. I mean, I think it just made me a better forester to kind of look at those things versus, I got so many acres I need to set up. I hunt this. I you know, what do the birds need? How do I help woodcock, grouse, and all the other species that come with it? But, you know, it's been really great that, you know, I've made my mark on the landscape and on the county forest for quite a while, and it's been fun to sort of learn as I go and sort of modify tweaks and make a better product, really, and to kind of maximize grouse density. But no one should come up and hunt these. These are sort of off limits. But anyways, maximize what these working lands can do, and as a grouse hunter, it gives me a unique opportunity.
Yeah, very cool. We're gonna circle back to some of that stuff. I've got a couple topics I want to cover before we get too deep into that, but I will say that it is a normal thing for me to do, and if I'm walking out of a piece of county property over your way, and I maybe have a grouse or two in the bag, I like to send Mike a text and usually say, keep up the great work.
Yeah, and I usually know right where he was, he shot it, because, you know, I know the forest like the back of my
hand. You know the tree. You can see the tree in the picture.
No, that's awesome. I mean, that's what those public lands are for, and I think it's awesome that people are out there enjoying it like I am, so no, cool.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we're going to table the grouse conversation for now, because one thing I really wanted to bring you on to talk about was turkeys. I've been talking a little bit turkeys on the podcast over the last month or so. The season is over now, so we're kind of past the peak turkey hype, but as you being one of my key turkey mentors, we were messaging back and forth along with our two other friends, Garrett and Ted, a lot over the turkey season as we're all doing a little bit of turkey hunting. You're hunting in northern Wisconsin primarily. You hunted entirely up there this year, didn't you?
I did. Yep. Okay. Basically all of it was in Bayfield County, I believe. Yep.
Yeah. So, and as we mentioned earlier, you grew up hunting and chasing turkeys around in southern Wisconsin, more traditional turkey habitat, I would venture to guess, and I want you to comment on sort of that and then coming up here. And you said something really interesting. This is what got me thinking about it after I just had my first successful hunt in like close to home, a lot closer to home than I had been hunting turkey in the previous few years, this idea that, you know, we didn't have them here. It wasn't that long ago before. And I didn't even know this, but you mentioned it on the BHA podcast that you were, I think, around for when they were actually releasing turkeys in Bayfield County. Would love to just sort of get your thoughts on like hunting them then and then quickly transitioning into like hunting turkeys in the Northwoods and like whatever you know of the history of turkeys in northern Wisconsin.
Sure. Yeah. I grew up hunting the traditional woodlot, farm field, edge, private land.
Yep.
Classic turkey woods down there, you know, and some public land is mixed in there, but you know, that was all I knew. You know, they roosted on the ridge tops and they come out to the field, and you know, it was just southern Wisconsin turkey hunting, and yeah, it was just so interesting to come up here, and you know, it just looks nothing like southern Wisconsin, which would be classic turkey woods. But yeah, 2000, I actually talked to the retired wildlife biologist yesterday just to sort of get my facts straight, and it was 2004 when they released birds in Bayfield County in three different locations. And one of those locations was on the county forest. And it was, I think it was like 25 birds or so. So that, yeah, I was here when they released those birds. And I don't remember, he didn't remember either how long it was after that we actually had a season. But it was, I remember when I first started here, I'd call the wildlife biologist. Yeah, I see birds north of Highway 2, which is halfway north in Bayfield County. Oh, I see birds within 100 yards of Lake Superior now. Yep. I mean, you could watch the march going north in real time, and it was just really interesting to basically show up, basically no turkeys, and then within half a dozen years, basically turkeys everywhere in the county, and a season showed up shortly thereafter, and I've been here ever since, basically, and to hunt the woods up here, it took some getting used to, and actually my dad started coming up the last couple of years to hunt, and you know, it was an eye opener. Like, okay, how do you scout and where do you go to, where do they roost? I mean, everything's just is a little bit different because it's forested systems and not fields and whatnot. So yeah, I've really had to, you know, and I've watched them, you know, and at work I get to see where a lot of the birds are, you know, hanging out. So I can kind of get a leg up on where to go scout and go hunt. But yeah, you know, like red pine plantations, classic roost, you know, mature red pine plantations. Yep. That's probably where they're going to roost. And, you know, these sand roads, they love to strut up and down sand roads. And then the sand roads and the sand country definitely tell a whole story about, okay, are they walking down these roads? And, you know, it's just in with endless public land, you can sort of get up in the morning and are they gobbling here? Nope. Drive another quarter mile. You hear them gobbling there. Nope. Drive another half mile. I mean, there's probably a half a million acres within 45 minutes of where I live. So, I mean, hardly any turkey hunting pressure. So you can basically cover a ton of real estate. And that's a lot different in down south where you have 80 acres to hunt or 40 acres to hunt and the birds are there or they're not. This, I mean, I can blow a whole day like nothing turkey hunting. It's nothing better for me than to get up in the morning and just sort of spend all day cruising and looking for birds. And that's what I did for dang near over a month this spring. So it's just with all the space and opportunity, the birds are basically equally spread out mostly across the landscape. So there's a lot of opportunity, but it was completely different than down south. And my dad's really enjoyed it. He's like, wow, we'll just go down the road and you go that way. And you know, you can just cover a lot of ground with all that public land to try and find a bird.
Yeah. Being a ruffed grouse and woodcock hunter here, kind of spoiled with public land, it's almost like the norm in your mind. So I could very easily imagine if you grew up hunting sort of the classic turkey country in, at least in the, you know, the couple of states that we're talking about, primarily a lot more private land, less public land, could see the appeal of being able to cover so much ground and hunt so much public land. Very, very cool. Did, when you were talking to the bird biologist, did he have any, and if we don't have the answers to any of this stuff, that's fine. I kind of like really want to get like a, almost like an expert on as far as like turkeys and northern expansion and that kind of thing. But when they were releasing birds, was there, do you have any idea what the thinking was? Like, were they maybe seeing birds at the time? Were there no birds? Or were they just saying like, hey, let's see if this works out? Or, I mean, there had to have been some historical perspective.
When I was talking to the retired biologist, I said, what was the impetus to release birds up here? Was there some sort of insights? He's like, we didn't want to do it, didn't think it would be successful. But then he started hearing reports of birds in Canada and birds in northern Minnesota. And so he said he went to a conference, I think in the Duluth area, where folks from Canada in further north of Wisconsin were going, yep, birds are doing well here. And I think there was a number of wildlife biologists going, geez, wow, okay, well, I guess we got to rethink what we think of as classic turkey cover. And even then, you know, when they made the decision, I think they were all pretty skeptical, like, yeah, we'll see what that first winter does,
right,
you know, for them to look for food and just how are they going to handle these winters. But I think it was the fact that birds had already moved further north in other parts of the country that got them thinking, well, okay, let's give it a shot. And so they kind of looked for areas that were more open on the county forest, thinking, well, they're related to fields. You know, here's, you know, young, you know, brushy open cover. Let's try and release them there. And just basically exceeded their expectations. I mean, I just think they were like, there's no way they're going to make the first winter. They made the first, they made the second, they made, and here they are. And
yeah,
recruitment seems to be really high. And even with tough winters, they seem to be bouncing back. And it'd be interesting for you to find an expert, because I think there's a lot of questions about winter survival. Where do they move? Are they all going to artificial food sources? Are they, you know, what kind of migratory patterns versus southern Wisconsin or southern Minnesota, where the, you know, the winters aren't really pushing birds around, but deer move in the winter. And, you know, I'm sure turkeys are kind of doing the same. Yeah, where are they going, and just what kind of reproductive success are they having up here? Because we don't have maybe as many raccoons or skunks or you know, other things that are hitting nests in the southern part of the state.
Sure.
You know, a lot of unanswered questions. But, yeah, it's just really neat to see a success story where they've done really well. And it seems stable. It's not like, I mean, I'd say consistently the birds are pretty much always been there the last 15 years. Where I go look for birds, I can generally find them.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of know the answer to this, but like along the lines of your comments about, you know, when they were thinking about, oh, let's maybe put them closer to fields and stuff, you know, you've been in the big woods up there, and I mean, you're pretty much finding them all over the place.
Oh,
right?
Even me, I catch myself going, I don't know if I'm going to go down this road. There's a lot of like continuous big forest.
Yeah.
And then I'll have a buddy like, yeah, I shot a bird down that road. I'm like, there's turkeys down that road? Even me, who like has covered everything, but you kind of get in your own world about where you had success, where you have turkey hunted, and it looks like red pine plantations with young jack pine clear cuts or red pine clear cuts nearby, and sort of that mix of open, that's where the birds are. Well, lo and behold, they're kind of everywhere. I just sort of keyed in on what I've identified as good turkey habitat. So I'm sort of constantly surprised, you know, the continuous bigger timber, sure enough, there's birds there too.
Yeah. I know. I recall one day specifically I was out hunting. It was in an area where I was grouse hunting. It was in the fall, and I was hunting with Jared Elm, who, you know, works for the Ruffed Grouse Society. And we were relatively deep in the cover, and we were hunting heavy soil, not sandy soil country, which maybe we'll get into that a little bit later with you on the podcast. But, you know, probably not the first thing you think of is like, oh, here's where the turkeys are going to be. And we were way back, about as far into the cover as we could get. And I think it was, I don't remember if I had Hartley on the ground or if I had Rose at the time. I think it was Hartley, and basically heard a commotion up ahead of us. And sure enough, here comes a turkey flying over my head. I swear I could have dropped it with the load of 7.5. It flew right over me, but I did not have a fall turkey tag that year, so I didn't shoot. But and Jared, I remember we were talking, because he was like, I mean, that turkey's not eating corn back here. There's nothing back here. Like we were that far into the cover, and sure enough, there's a turkey.
I remember there's a huge swamp in the center part of the county called the Bibbin Swamp. I remember seeing turkeys like come out of the alder brush on one side. It's just water and alder brush. They come out one side into the road, cross, and go the other way. I'm like, what are these birds doing? Where are they? What are they eating? They have web feet in here. I mean, like, what is this habitat? Like, nobody would have been like, oh, classic turkey habitat. And we were like a mile from, you know, high ground. It's just amazing what they're seeing as habitat that they can survive in. It's just crazy.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like it based on your comments, but like no noticeable decline or anything coming out of this winter. And I don't know what your thoughts are over that way, but I feel like it was a cold winter with plenty of snow. Maybe not what you would think would be great for turkeys, but they did okay, I think.
I think so too. I was hearing some reports of like the bird numbers being down, but I was out a lot. I don't think that's the case. I think it's stable. It seemed no different to me than it had been the last half a dozen years. So I think everything is business as usual, which is great. The birds are there, and I fully expect them to continue. I mean, we had a bad winter in 2013-14, and there were reports of birds, you know, dead birds all over the place, and But again, I think recruitment is really high, and they bounce back pretty quick. If they can handle a deep, deep snow winter like that,
right,
they can handle anything, because that was kind of off the charts for winter severity.
I honestly have no idea what they eat in the winter. I think I've heard that they're budding in trees and stuff. I mean, do you even know what they're eating in the winter? I mean, are they eating hazel catkins? Or
I'm not sure, to be honest, what they're doing. But I think of that, like on these cold, wet mornings, I'm thinking, man, those birds are up here, you know, roosting in a tree in northern Wisconsin or Minnesota, like just a wind howling and a blizzard.
Imagine
I'm like,
that.
Geez, I can't even imagine just how, you know, a deer tucks into the brush, or those grouse are buried
the
in
snow.
The snow.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking those turkeys are sitting perched up in some conifer, which might help a little bit, but those are some tough birds.
No kidding. Yeah, absolutely. If you can stay out all night in some of the nights we have here in the depths of winter, yeah, that's a hardy bird without a doubt. What are your, we won't spend too much more time talking about this, but what are your, you kind of touched on it, but what are your favorite, like, what's your go-to method for hunting big woods, north woods turkeys? What do you like to do?
What do I like to do? I like to key in on big pine. I think having a mature red pine plantation, or if it's aspen or hardwood or oak or something, I think it seems to me they tend to favor big pine trees, mature pine trees. So if there's like a stand of aspen with, you know, scattered big pine mixed in, you know, that's what I'm going to be focused in on. But I mostly mature red pine plantations seem like that seems to hold a lot, that's good roosting for the birds. It seems like birds roost in mature pine plantations, and we have a lot of them. So yeah. I tend to really key in on anchor around pine stands, mature pine stands, and then kind of branch out from there. I mean, it's always a good starting point. I have found birds in spots where like, where did they roost? You know, I don't even see a roost tree here, and I'll see them walking down a sand road. But I do, you know, I'm always looking for roost sites. And for me, that's big towering pine. And that seems to be where I hear most of those birds are, in pine trees. So I think that's the start. Basically I go from there, and then it's just, again, these public lands we have a ton of roads, so you can get right wherever you want. And so I think between just scouting, that's taking your time on the roads, and a lot like the sand country is where I hunt a lot. I think you can, they tell a heck of a story. The birds are on these roads, and you just sort of, as you're driving along, you can be like, oh, yep, there's strut marks here. Yep. Okay. Maybe, yep, I can look around and you know, maybe they're roosting over there, but they do bounce around the roost sites. I mean, I've tried to pattern birds, and you know, they seem just like anything else. They kind of bounce around their roost sites, so you can't always, but generally, you know, within half a mile or something, they're going to be there. But, you know, I think part of it's just, you know, scouting, time in the woods.
Yeah.
There's generally more grouse there than people think. There's generally more turkeys there. You know, they're not gobbling this morning, but, you know, maybe not where I was at. And so I think I've been humbled multiple times, like, geez, they're not gobbling. Boy, maybe there's nothing around. And then I'll have a buddy text me who's on public land a mile away, gobbling their heads off. And it's like, wow, I should have been over there. So I think you just got to be persistent and just, you know, just get in the woods. And it can look like, well, is this turkey woods? And I just trust that. Just like when I told, you know, Nick years ago, where are the birds? They're in the woods. Just keep walking. They're there. Trust them. They're in the woods. And so I think you know, just sticking with it, you just sort of can have faith that a lot of it's pretty good habitat. And I've had enough experience finding birds in that habitat that they're there, whether they're, you know, gobbling or not. Just, you know, be patient and stick with it. But
yeah,
no big secrets. Yeah. Mature pine and sand roads.
Yeah. That's helpful. I mean, again, you see turkey tracks, like that is especially like for me this year, like I was hunting, I didn't hunt Wisconsin. I only hunted Minnesota, but I was going to areas that I had never hunted before. And to be frank, didn't even know if there was turkeys there, because again, this conversation of like, well, where are they? Like, how are they up this far? And are they all over the place? And the ability to obviously see tracks. I mean, that's, you know, it's basic hunting 101, but boy, is that a big confidence booster when you can follow those roads and see the tracks and know that the birds kind of use the roads. I mean, that's helpful.
Yes.
I think for turkey hunting,
right? I think like deer tracks, like, okay, you see deer tracks, like, okay, how do you hunt the track? You know, it's a good trail. But I think when you find deer turkeys using, and especially strut zones, and you know, it's like I've made countless decisions to hunt an area just based on, you know, fairly recent strut marks. It's like, generally, he's probably going to come through here sometime. I don't know which way or whatnot. Those sand roads or just roads in general, turkeys really seem to use those corridors quite a bit up here. We don't have the fields, and they're picking, you know, grit and stuff along those town roads and sand roads, and we just have roads everywhere. So you can kind of cover the ground well too, and just, you know, keep an eye out for, you know, that sign.
So you got your bird early, and then kind of, as you alluded to earlier, spent the rest of the season going out with other people and helping them out. Obviously, you enjoy being out on the county forest. And yeah, with the late spring we had this year, it was like once it finally got nice, it was like any excuse to get out there and watch the woods wake up and maybe hear a bird gobble. Yeah.
Yeah, I took out, I think, 5 or 6 friends, and some of them had success, some didn't, and I was out a lot on my own. Just, something about, watching that spring woods wake up, whether you're hearing birds or whippoorwills or not. There's so much ground to cover up here, and just, it's a great time to be out in the woods. So it's addictive. Just like grouse, I'm addicted to grouse hunting. I've become more and more addicted to turkey hunting or scouting. Like I said, I have just as much fun interacting with the bird without a weapon, just to get close, just to see him, just take some pictures, just to interact with him. I tend to call a lot less when I'm not hunting. I don't really want to educate them. And I can learn a lot by not having the gun. It takes a lot of the pressure off. So I end up becoming a smarter hunter. How can I ambush this bird? How I don't want to educate him. I don't want to bump him. I want him to just sort of walk by me close, not even know I'm there. And so, it's a different way of getting at the birds. And it's just as exciting as pulling the trigger.
Well, all your early morning texts really lit a fire under me, and you were out there for like a month before I even hunted. My season was right at the end, but it was definitely good motivation to get out there, and you had already had about, I don't know, 10, 20 toms in range, but I finally got it done. So it was
you did, cool. And I am really excited for you. I mean, I remember seeing those texts, tracks. What do I got? Hey, I've seen the same hen. Yeah. The same hen. Is this the same hen that I saw last time? And then, just the expression on your face when you called in those birds, when you sent that text or that photo of you, it's just, you get hooked. When you start interacting with those birds, even if you don't kill them, you just get them close and did it on your, you were doing the calling. Yeah. Man, I tell you, that rush is hard to beat. And just interacting with game like that, awesome work for you. You stuck with it, and heck of a hunt.
Yeah, it was cool. I will say, I feel like I had kind of almost like a storybook turkey season, and like being on, my hunt with Garrett didn't work out this year. So I was on my own hunting new area, which, turned out to be a great thing for me, but it's like every hurdle, could have been the moment where I said, screw this, it's not going to work out. But to be fair, like, I found tracks the first day, and I saw a couple hens the first day, and then the next day I was out, I found that big strut zone, and I was texting you guys like, are these strut marks? Like, I didn't believe it, and it was a cool spot, and I just feel like every day I was out, for a total of 5, I think, like, I got like another carrot, like another piece of the puzzle came together, and then my buddy and I had a cool encounter, and then the next day I was out, I ended up getting a bird. But yeah, it was super cool. And that classic turkey hunting where, nothing's going on, and then all of a sudden, boom,
that is turkey hunting right there. Just like nothing. Holy cow. Get down, get ready. Here it comes. Mm-hmm. And it's addictive. And I'm sure you're going to be doing it again next year with a different mindset. Yeah. Like, there's birds here. I've seen birds here. I got confidence. We can do this. And it just builds. And it's neat to kind of watch, work through that progression. And taking my friends out and coworkers, I have so much experience turkey hunting, and I enjoy doing it by myself, but it's fun to share it. But just like sort of getting people, it can be intimidating. Like, okay, how do I start? They're not saying anything. Anyways, when you have some of that success, it really feeds on itself.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think maybe the calling aspect of turkey hunting makes it seem like it's almost unattainable if you don't really know what you're doing. But like, that was another thing this year. I proved myself, like, with the bare minimum amount of calling, I was able to get it done, and I had birds responding and stuff. So that was a big deal. But I think when you're new or from the outside looking in, maybe this is how I felt, I think, was just like, oh my gosh, like, you got to be able to call these birds in, I think you can get in contact with the right bird where it's just like, he's coming in, whereas other birds take more coaxing that I probably don't have the experience to get through. But just knowing that you can do it and seeing it happen was, again, a huge, huge leap forward, I would say.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. I want to keep going on this confidence thing, in that this is something that I think it's a perk of your job, in that you spend a lot of time in the woods. And when it comes to exploring, let's say we're talking rough grouse cover now, when it comes to exploring and finding new covers, you have this benefit or bonus where you're going into covers for work and you're flushing birds via your work. And again, the simple fact, the simple act of flushing a bird, it's just like, it kind of like flips a switch in your mind about like, okay, I've got confidence. Even if you weren't expecting to find a bird there, you see it happen. And I mean, talk about like how that sort of plays into your mindset. You're sort of willing to go in anywhere because you've maybe seen a bird there, you know, when you were checking timber during the summer or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I flush birds in all the habitat. And granted, right, we all know there's certain aspects of habitat where birds will congregate and spend time certain times of the year. But just like the amount of opportunity I've had to interact with birds that, A, get you fired up, there's birds here, and maybe not even classic cover, but that means if I'm in cover or I'm passing through cover where I feel like some people are like, hey, this is too old or this is just a different species, I'll be like, I can just like, well, I've moved birds plenty of times at work in cover like this, so you know, I'll keep walking. And I know there's another stand behind that might be more age appropriate for maybe having a higher density of birds, but just as I'm setting up mature aspen that's 50, 60 years old with balsam mixed in, I mean, I swear sometimes there's as many birds in that as there is in the classic aspen. And so I just look at like, just there's good in like northern hardwood stands or oak stands. If you got stem density and you got some conifer mixed in, or you got some wetland areas mixed in, it just feels like I can, you know, basically get into birds everywhere I go. So when I'm hunting, I just feel like it's all birdie, and you know, it ebbs and flows, and you kind of got to be realistic about, you know, how birdie and how close the dogs are going to get. If it's a really open northern hardwood stand, certain times of the year you can get a lot of action in that. And if you didn't spend a lot of time sort of working in that, or like I do at work, I'd be like, this is a dead zone, this is going to be a waste of time. But no, it gives me a lot of confidence to just sort of, I know the birds are here. I got the kind of experience no one else has. I spend basically every day of the week out here kind of understanding through timber sales and doing reconnaissance where grouse and woodcock are hanging out. So I can definitely be, I see a lot as maybe birdie habitat that other people would be like, well, you know, I don't know about that. And I just, you know, personally, I've moved a lot of birds here. I've got 20 years experience sort of moving birds in this kind of cover. And so I'll spend time hunting in that where most people maybe wouldn't, but just sort of on my way to the next cover, it definitely keeps you. Keeps you kind of focused and, you know, expecting like this isn't necessarily a waste of time. So, yeah, no, it's a real benefit. I mean, you'd think I'd shoot a big buck every year too, because, you know, I get to, you know, do that, but I don't. And, but I do, I get to see the deer, the turkeys, and the sign. It's just definitely something I get to spend a lot of time seeing at work that most people, you know, don't. They show up and they have expectations like, I got to maximize my short window. And, you know, and again, I live up here, so I can hunt another, it's a Monday, I can go hunting Tuesday, Wednesday, so I can have a lot more patience and spending a lot of time in different parts of, you know, the forest and age clash. But I think the bottom line is there's birds kind of throughout all those timber types. Yeah. And at certain times of the year, they kind of ebb and flow, but definitely I feel like there's a lot more birds out there than people realize in cover they're not spending any time in hunting.
Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and Fred of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com.
So on that note, when you're going to go hunt somewhere, let's say you're going to hunt somewhere new, do you think about, what are the top things that you are thinking about? Are you looking for an age-appropriate aspen stand, want that to be a component, or are you thinking more like exploration? You want to check this out or that out? What goes through your mind as far as like hunting a new spot?
Yeah, I'd say I'm always anchoring it on age-appropriate aspen.
Which is easy to do because there's so much of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly right. I think, you know, age-appropriate aspen, but that's step one. Step two is there's plenty of age-appropriate aspen where it's just pure aspen with not much diversity. And that, you know, if I could go, you know, if that's on one side of the road versus maybe sort of a mixed aspen stand with conifer and maybe some oak seed trees that have been left, you know, I'm going to go there instead. You know, there's just more value added from the diversity. The birds like the diversity. They need stem density. But I think that interface of different things, conifer mixed in, riparian areas mixed in. So I'm really looking at complexity within a smaller area, not like 150-acre pure aspen clear cut. And, you know, some soils and some timber sales are just going to be that way. There's just not a lot of conifer in there. And certain times of the year, the birds will be there. But maybe I'll hunt more of the edges of that stuff. But yeah, I'm looking always for complexity, a dirty aspen stand, you know, harvest that in terms of just having different species mixed in, not a you know, poorly done logging job, but just, you know, I'd like aspen with age appropriate. I'd like conifer components, but not too much conifer. I mean, too much conifer is hard to hunt. Those, you know, you get in there, there's birds there, and it's like, well, okay, am I better off spending my time trying to like not never see a bird? So, you know, I like just a little bit of conifer. And certain times of the year, you know, the birds are going to spend more time in thicker conifer, and you just got to be smart about that more late season hunting and where they want to be. But age appropriate, and I like wetland edges. I like natural openings.
Yeah.
And oaks, scatter residual oak. I mean, Nick, you can attest to this. I mean, you're kind of like looking at those as, you know, the acorn. I mean, I think especially our management, we're leaving more scattered retention out in these aspen cuts, and really they could be oak harvest that we're doing more of an even aged clear cut type prescription to regenerate the oak and the maple and the aspen, and those scattered oak are providing acorns in certain times of the year. I mean, that's there's a lot of things going to those acorns, and so I think it's you know, those are all the good things I'm looking at.
Oaks over aspen, as our mutual friend Ted likes to say. I like that saying.
Yeah,
that's a beautiful sight when you've got you've got an aspen cut that is in the age where it needs to be, and you can see some big mature oak trees scattered about. And I mean, I've gotten to the point where I've talked about this a lot, where, you know, the area that I grew up hunting didn't have a lot of oak trees, so it's kind of new to me. But I mean, if I see oak trees, I will make a point of walking under every single one of those. And, you know, I might walk under 100 and flush a grouse under one of them, but it sure feels good when you intentionally did that and you flush a grouse, you know?
Yeah, well, you're doing it from experience, and then you're in the cover anyway, so to get from one to the next isn't like, well, geez, you know, I'm wasting, you know, it's all good cover. And it's just like, you know, those are objectives. You know, we talk about objectives in grouse hunting and what it is you're in there for. But I mean, I don't know how much we want to get into this in terms of hunting. Well, I guess I'll just, like, I've switched breeds on dogs, and with the different breed, the setter, I've hunted totally different in these covers, and the way I pick covers and how I move through them has really changed. So that means the stand, the area I'm hunting can be a lot smaller than it used to. I used to, like, you know, lean forward and practically run down the trail and maximize my time in the woods. And I needed a lot more cover to spend, you know, a few hours. But now with my setter, I move a lot less fast and spend a lot more time letting the dog find the grouse, which makes a lot more sense. You know, as I say it out loud, I should have been doing that a long time ago. But as my young exuberance, like, lean forward, cover the ground, birds are going to be in there, let's get after it. And I think I was just probably moving too fast and not, you know, covering the actual cover that I thought I was covering. So, you know, now I'm hunting smaller and smaller areas and just taking more and more time. And I think what I'm finding is there's a lot of birds. I walk by, everybody walks by, because the dogs just don't have, we're not giving them as much time as maybe we should to kind of hunt a cover that you're in versus just sort of move through it quickly.
Yeah. And I know you've had that conversation with Kyle Warren, former guest of the show. And I wanted to bring him up at this point anyways, because really in me asking you like how you're sort of choosing and setting up your hunts, it's kind of something that Kyle put in my head in the last time I interviewed him, which was, I don't know, a few months ago. We were talking, and, you know, I was sort of talking about like what I looked at for in covers, and I knew this about Kyle, and he kind of reiterated it on that interview that, you know, his really at the top of the chart for him is as many bird contacts as humanly possible as he can get for his dogs, no matter where they are. And a lot of times that is in that trashy, terrible cover. You know, I've talked to you about hunting with him. He mentioned it on the show. And I think sometimes, as much as I think I'm trying to maximize bird contacts, I do think that sometimes I'm choosing like an aesthetic of a car. I'm choosing to hunt covers that I want to be in and want to walk through, and maybe giving up some bird contacts here and there. Now, I still think I have a good chance of finding birds, but that's an interesting way to think about, you know, how you're choosing your covers, I think.
I got a Paint River here. I've had Weimaraners, and I shot a lot of birds over Weimaraners, and but I, you know, generalist versus specialist, and so I, who's doing the most hunting with, you know, their dogs? Well, it just seemed like Kyle really spends a lot of time after. But I couldn't believe it when I went hunting with him before I got a dog from him. I swear we'd, you know, he's got 7 or 8 dogs he's got to run a day, so it's 8 hours a day. The guy's the real deal. I was like, okay, let's see how this will be interesting, how it goes. I mean, we would spend 45 minutes dang near within sight of the truck. And I'd be like, well, the good cover is over there yet further. We didn't even get into the good cover. And he's like spinning circles. And I can see basically the truck for 45 minutes. And it's like, yeah, yep, 8 to 10 grouse an hour we moved here. And I'm thinking, we're not even in the good cover. And so it's like, I learned a lot. I'm like, geez, this guy is like basically not moving. And covers a very small area and cover thoroughly, that I wouldn't really spend time in. And so I learned a lot, like, well, I guess just like you said, you know, aesthetically we're kind of keyed in, and this is classic grouse cover. And it is. And those birds are there too. But there's a lot more birds in cover that I just was like, this is walkthrough cover. This is like drive-by cover. And Kyle's like, I don't have time to do that. I got to run dogs all day, every day.
Right.
And, you know, he can take a cover that you and I might spend 2 hours saying, yeah, we hunted it. And he'll drop 6 dogs in and just piecemeal the whole thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, cover all of it really well. So, yeah, for me, it's really changed how I've hunted. And I've slowed way up and just spent a lot of time in one cover. And, frankly, the bird numbers are, you know, the setter hunts a little differently than the YM anyways, sure, in terms of, you know, bird contacts and whatnot. But I need a lot less cover to spend as much or more time. And I don't mind. As I'm getting older, I'd like to I'm going to keep busting brush forever, but it's been a good change. I've really enjoyed having a kind of that thorough working, you know, all around me, take our time. But Kyle's really, we're not moving. We're barely moving, Kyle. And then he'll like run up 50 yards real quick and then stop again and let the dog work. And it's like just a totally different style of hunting that I've ever had. And it's just like, you learned a lot. I mean, I think having an open mind about different techniques, how people read the cover, and what you want to do and what you're willing to do. And even you, Nick, you know, as your transition from a partridge hunter to a grouse hunter, I mean, you're coming into the cover that I've hunted a lot, and you're coming in with a new set of eyes and what you're keying in. And I'm listening to what you're finding, because I can learn, you know, your set of eyes and your analytical way of looking at it. You know, I think we all kind of get in a rut about, you know, what the habitat is and where I find birds. And I think, you know, keeping an open mind of what habitat is and where the birds are moving through, and just, you know, being open-minded to the habitat, because again, the bottom line is there's just generally more birds out there than I realized. I just sort of walked by a lot of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's great. And that's, I mean, it's one of my favorite parts of, I think, of this podcast, and really any of the conversations that I would have or a listener would have with their friends. You know, these are the things you sit around and talk about. It's like, you do it one way, and, you know, I've got similar to you, I think, you know, like a little bit of wanderlust. Like, I like to explore and see the, I mean, there's so much country to see and explore. Yeah. Sometimes I'm planning my hunts and, like, you know, I want to make this big, huge loop, and maybe I'm leaning forward, you know, like you mentioned, and covering ground and pushing my dog past birds. And I might be okay with that because I wanted to see that country. But when we come back to think about grouse hunting and bird contacts and like what are those other factors and variables, like you said, keep an open mind, and the more you understand, the better you're able to set up your own hunts and sort of tailor them to what you want to accomplish, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I do. Kyle moves too. I don't want to see my truck for 45 minutes. I don't need to go drop another dog either. And like you said, I like the big woods. I like covering ground. So I'm kind of got that hybrid, knowing if I'm moving quick, I'm probably moving quicker than I should. But I'd like to go see that cedar swamp. I'd like to kind of go on that ridge. I'd like to take that trail back. So, you know, you kind of know what you're giving up by moving that fast. But, you know, I kind of like to, see what's over the next hill, or, and scout new covers too. You know, if you're always Kyle's kind of got to crank out bird contacts, but there's something to see there. I learned a lot, and I'm kind of got a new hybrid approach.
Yeah, I love it. Love it. I want to talk sandy soil, clay soil. This is a topic that I have broached before on the podcast, and you and I have talked about it a lot. It was one of the most eye-opening things for me when I started hunting in Wisconsin, because as I've mentioned many times before, I grew up hunting a relatively small portion of Minnesota that was basically all heavy clay soil, and I did not have a lot of experience on the sand. Now, the sand is not unique to Wisconsin. There are sand country in Minnesota. There's sand country in Michigan. Really, it's kind of like the area that I was hunting, the Arrowhead of Minnesota, if you will. That's pretty much clay soil, and that's kind of more unique, I would say, than the sandy soil, clay soil. But talk about, from your perspective as a forester, like the diversity within Bayfield County and this portion of Wisconsin that we're talking about, like the changing of soil types. I mean, you drive 5 miles on US Highway 2 and it's like sand, and then it's clay, and then it's sand, and then it's clay. I mean, it's kind of crazy how all that works.
Yeah, Bayfield County and the timber that reflected based on the soil differences. I mean, Bayfield County's got clay up by Lake Superior, which extends, half a dozen miles in from the shore at least. Mm-hmm. And so the aspen cover type in the clay is nothing like the aspen that is in sand country. I mean, we have, alder brush mixed in. We got, a lot more balsam fir mixed in. And just the forbs are just totally different. The ground cover can be completely different. Yeah, it's so night and day. You get onto the scrub oak aspen where it's just like basically no understory, really wide open, bracken fern, holding cover can be kind of a challenge because it can be like good stem density, but like no shrub layer in the understory.
Yep.
And then you go, into the, quarter mile down the road and it's hazel brush as thick as can be. And so like, you look at Onyx Hunt and you're like, aspen, classic aspen. You get in there and there's just like in Bayfield County, it could be, chock full of balsam fir. It could be so thick a hazel brush, or it could be wide open, and all have the exact same stem density of aspen. So it's just the soil types. And I used to feel like if you want to find the grouse, you got to go to the clay. The clay's got more diversity. It's got more of that conifer component. And as again, that's where I went. That was my assumption. That's what people told me. And then I said, well, let's go. I'm at work. I'm flushing birds in scrub oak. I'm flushing birds in sandy ground. There's woodcock. I swear there's more woodcock in a red pine plantation than anybody ever realizes, because that's where I seem to find most of them. So I think based on my work experience and then just sort of I get my hunting hat on and be like, go to the clay. And I'm thinking like, well, I hunt the clay a lot and I move birds there, but there's a lot of the county forest that I'm not spending much time in. But at work, I seem to be, I'm going to go try the scrub oak. I'm going to go try that sand. And I started having good success. And, my friends would be like, that liver on you, like, what are you hunting the sand aspen for? There's no birds in that. And I'm thinking, well, my work tells me there's plenty of birds there. So I've doubled the basic huntable area for rough grouse hunting, which is sort of, kind of like a idiot. There's birds everywhere. That. But even me, I was a little stubborn to kind of move into the sand aspen and spend some time there. Because some of that can be certain times of the year, those birds can be really hard to hunt because there isn't much ground cover in certain stands. Yep. And the birds are in there, but they run way ahead of you and you're just not getting good shots. Or you're, there's a lot of pine plantations where there's plenty of grouse and jack pine and red pine, but you can't see them, so you don't spend much time in there hunting. So you really got to kind of figure out which sand aspen, but that scrub oak component, an aspen mix, it can be really, it'd be a high density of birds. So but super diverse. I mean, you can't just say, go and find the aspen. All the aspen is a little different on Bayfield County based on the soils, which I think is really exciting. There's just a lot of diversity and diversity is good.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would say that, I was that guy that basically, I start hunting this new area and I pull up to a spot because I figured out there was aspen there, looking at a map or something, and I'm standing there looking at an aspen tree, but I'm like, something doesn't look right. This doesn't look like what I was expecting to find, right? And it wasn't until, I think it was probably you that touched on it initially, or I picked up on it somewhere, but just once I started paying attention to the soil types, then that put everything into context for me. And I was like, okay, so heavy soil is what I'm familiar with. That's the cover type that I have all this history and confidence with. I was starting from scratch basically in the sand country. And then there's a kind of that mixed country where you've got hardwood and you might have some potholes and some swales and stuff, but you don't necessarily have a bunch of swamps, yep, riparian corridors. But it was like a level up moment for me in grouse hunting when I started paying attention to soil type and then how that influences the cover type on the ground. Like you said, there's birds in both, but they use it a little bit differently, and there's a lot of factors going on that you wouldn't necessarily see that are actually affecting like your hunting experience and what the birds are doing on in that cover.
And I think the general consensus, I tend to see more grouse hunters, I would say, in the clay country than I see in some of that scrubbier aspen. And I mean, I hope no one's listening to this podcast, but I mean, I just think there's a lot of untapped ground. Cause you know, I think you think about it, but it seems like, you know, the clay and some of the obvious diversity that's there is just sort of, this is birdie, you know, it looks birdie, it's got all these things. And that dry aspen, I don't know, that seems more sterile, and it's just maybe not going to be as productive, but there's birds pretty much all over the place.
Yeah, I'm definitely fighting a long history on the heavy soil type, clay soil stuff, and lots of bird contacts over the years in that stuff. So like, the sand country is at a disadvantage in that, in my mind, you know, like it would take a lot for me to get there, but slowly but surely I'm getting there, because, you know, I spend enough time over at my cabin and I'm driving around and spending time on some of these high sandy barren areas where I know there's, you know, again, you can go find age appropriate aspen as far as the eye can see. It's all over the place. And one of the things that got me going on it too was turkey hunting. I focused on the sand country for some of those reasons we talked about when I was hunting over there a couple of years ago, just so you could see tracks and stuff. And wouldn't you know it, I'm hearing grouse drumming like crazy in that sand country.
that was, I think, a big turning point for me about 15 years ago. It's like I would turkey hunting in the sand. I'm like, there's grouse drumming all over the place down here.
Yep.
Like, this is crazy. I got to like remember this, and that hazel brush component and some of those, you know, we have a lot of like kind of poorly stocked maturing pine areas, and it's just 100% hazel brush. And like, frankly, a grouse factory, hard to hunt them, but like just the drumming in the spring is a good time to be out, because you can do a lot of scouting. There's verification. There's birds here. They're drumming.
Yeah. Yeah. On the forestry side of things, this is something that you mentioned it earlier before we kind of segued into turkeys, and I wanted to come back to it. This draws on a lot of conversations that we've had over the years. And, you know, when you're setting up timber sales, it isn't, I'd be curious, you can fill me in on like how certain things are ranked as far as like, you know, marketable product, revenue of the sale, but then you're thinking about conifer clumps and drumming logs. And I mean, wildlife are a component to sustainable forestry. Wildlife management fits into that. So how do you think about that? And then what controls and like influences do you have in setting up those timber sales to create that balance between a successful timber sale and sustainable wildlife populations?
Yeah, good question. I would say that is definitely an ongoing conversation, even within our department and the DNR. I think I think we're managing timber, which creates, and we have a large land base, and so we have diversity in age classes, and of course we there's wildlife that are on the forest as part of this diversity. But okay, great, you know, foresters are setting up the wood, these are the species that move into it after the timber sale, and you know, you have young age class, middle age class, older timber, set aside areas, and so we have the full suite. Okay, great, foresters set up the wood, wildlife staff is happy. But as I'm getting more experienced, we're going to set up 1,000 acres of aspen on the county forest every year, and that's going to be probably wrapped up in 15 or 20 different aspen timber sales. So, you know, 100 acres, 80 acres a piece. So let's say, okay, within that, what is it, you know, that we need to do or think about to value add tweaks to say, okay, it's going to be young forest, but what are the things that we could do more to maybe make it a better quality timber sale wildlife. And so the DNR, I've been working with the DNR on some of these best management practices for young forest, and just, you know, what are ways to provide, you know, patch sizes that are, you know, appropriate size, drumming logs. I mean, frankly, I read The Passion for Grouse and read a chapter in there from a retired professor down at University of Minnesota.
Gutierrez.
Yeah, exactly. He had a sentence in there, a paragraph in there about how, you know, these whole tree harvesting operations where they utilize basically the whole tree is doesn't allow much for coarse-weighted debris. There could be a potential deficit of drumming logs. And, you know, we have a lot of high volume and very small utilization on some of our younger aspen sales. And they look pretty clean when they're done. And I'm thinking, you know, we could get good stem density, but geez, maybe we're missing drumming log opportunities. And so he made a comment about like maybe not having occupancy of a male grouse in there because, you know, the stem density is great, but you're missing a place for that bird to set up shop. And so I reached out to him and said, hey, you know, this is something I'm concerned about. We may be setting up sales that are missing this component because our you know, it's maybe a 45-year-old aspen stand and the average diameter of that those aspen trees are 8 inches. And we, you know, we could mark some trees to leave, but they're aspen. And you know, we don't maybe have a lot of diversity in the stand to, you know, currently laying on the ground. What can we do to make sure we're not, you know, we're not lacking drumming logs? And so our department developed with the wildlife staff and Rocky developed a drumming log policy. And we've been implementing that, you know, so many trees per acre, and I'm marking a tree at 5 feet and usually an oak and usually 14 inches in diameter or greater. And the logger, we're having the logger, you know, cut that tree at 5 feet up and lay that tree in the ground as sort of a guard object that's sort of mimicking the tip up. And this was all through their guidance. And this is something that I help advocate for and say, hey, we can do better. My job is to set up a timber sale, but what are some of the other things I can do to add more benefit? And so we've implemented this drumming log policy. And again, I don't know if birds are necessarily going to use it or not, but that's a little thing we can do along the way to just maybe ensure, even if it's not for grouse, it could be salamanders. I mean, some of these stands just generally lack coarse-weighted debris. And so it's okay to leave some of these trees on the ground indefinitely. And then, you know, and so we have some retention. Part of our aspen clear cutting is we want to retain 3-5% of the original stand as a remnant of the original stand. And so that's part of our certification process. So you can do that.
So that would be the trees left standing?
Yes, trees left standing within that harvest unit. And that could be like leave all balsam fir and there might be 15 trees out there. Or there's a riparian management zone that we're not going to set up because, you know, to protect water quality. And so I can get credit for that. You know, there could be a little finger of RMZ that runs into the sale. Or that may not happen. And then we just say, okay, well, how are we going to find these? We have retention guidelines that we need to hit. And so lately I've been moving towards, instead of scattered trees, red maple and even oak, you know, I think what we've been moving towards is, where I've been moving more towards is patches, you know, an acre retention, 3/4 of an acre retention. And I think even when you have an 80 or 100 acre clear cut, and if I can do 1 acre retention patches every 100 yards, and then even do that retention patch isolate where maybe the conifer component is higher within parts of that stand and actually keep that as the retention, so then those birds can move into that within an aspen clear cut, move into that retention patch that actually has balsam in it. It might be good roosting cover in the winter. It could be winter feeding cover in the mature aspen. And I think you can break up these large units with these strategic retention patches that I'm hoping will provide lots of value to a lot of species versus just one tree here, one tree there, one tree there. So I think it's just my curiosity to be like, okay, we're setting up the wood. You know, what are we doing for wood turtles? What are we doing for the Connecticut warbler? What are we, I mean, we can provide, you know, value added. And if it's tweaks here and there, let's do it. And so I think my passion for grouse hunting has started looking at, okay, home ranges for grouse. What does a grouse need for within one flight of the drumming log? Yeah. Winter cover, you know, winter feeding cover. And, you know, how do I help maximize the needs? So I think with our riparian management zones that sort of go into these timber sales, they provide some of those opportunities and retention patches. And so I think just elevating, at least for me, is just how can I be the best forester possible and factor in all these other things that on my watch, as I set them up, I want to make sure we're providing as good a habitat for all species, game and non-game. And that's just, I think all foresters in general want to do that. I've just been really sort of outspoken on like, what are we doing? Is it working? And how can we kind of keep doing better?
Yeah. That's super cool. How did the edges of a timber sale get defined, because I mostly what I see when I'm out on public lands hunting the edge of a clear cut or something, it's not straight lines. It's not a big square. And I think, you know, there's some thought process there as far as like a straight line wouldn't necessarily be a good thing. If you create this weaving edge, you can create more edge cover and more diversity in that edge. But I'm just curious, like, how does the edge get defined? Is it based on the trees that you're trying to cut? Are you purposefully like drawing a line? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, great question. You know, it's funny, people will drive through the forest and they'll be like, oh, that's a cut, you know, why there and not over there? Or could you go cut somewhere else? Because that's my backyard and we're always in somebody's backyard. So don't worry, we're going to be cutting in their backyard someday too. It's just a matter of time. But like, people just drive through the forest and again, they're just seeing the woods and they're seeing this sail or not a sail. And for me, I'm looking at GIS data. You know, I'm looking at the computer and saying, you know, the forest has been mapped. Everything's broken into what we call stands. So this could be a red pine plantation. This could be a 40-year-old aspen stand that's 80 acres right next to a wetland drainage. And this could be an oak stand that's 120 acres and that's been thinned once. So the forest is just broken up into polygons. So when I'm at work and we have to determine how many acres that we're going to cut every year, everything's on a rotation. We're going to thin oak at 70 years, and we're going to thin northern hardwood every 15 years. And so, you know, based on all these, we're going to clear cut red aspen at 45 to 55 years old. And so every year we can just generate, this is our acreage, this is our species composition, this is our allowable harvest. And so then within that, I could say, here's an aspen stand that's 120 acres. And usually it's, you know, maybe a younger aspen stand right next door, or it's an oak stand, or it's a drainage. So the stands sort of, they've all been mapped and drawn out based on historic management through time has generated this patchwork of different age classes and different species that were perpetuating oak or perpetuating northern hardwood, perpetuating aspen through a clear cut. So, you know, all these different species have a respective silvicultural practice to ensure, you know, we want to maintain oak on the landscape. We want to maintain northern hardwood, which is sugar maple, basswood, yellow birch. We want to maintain our red pine acreage and jack pine. And so we're doing all, you know, as a forester, that's my job, is to ensure like the planning process of continual management of these species. And so as part of doing that is, you know, the appropriate harvest technique. So a lot of the sale boundaries lay themselves out. It's not like an arbitrary, hey, I'm going to just do this, because usually it's up against some other timber type or age class.
Gotcha.
And I'd say the more complex part of the job now is just harvesting practices in 1970 or 75, where we maybe were more aggressive and just going down that drainage and up the other side and down that drainage and up the other side. Now, you know, BMP's best management practices for water quality and protecting some of these more sensitive stream areas, or not even necessarily active streams, just more head cuts or drainage dry washes, we call them. Just to do more, just to keep equipment out of that, I'm doing a lot more boundary work on adding those into the timber sale that weren't there in 1970 when, frankly, we just sort of said cut from one side to the other. So the complexity of the sales in terms of setup time and even just complexity for wildlife benefit of having more diversity, the sales of, you know, there are a lot more going on now than back in the day. And that's a good thing. You know, I think
These
are all things we want to achieve. So, you know, I'm going out there and I'll do a walkthrough. You know, I'll have my mapping and I'll say, okay, this is the acres I need to go. And I'll go walk it and kind of determine, okay, yep, I got to put an RMZ, riparian management zone here, a RMZ over there. And I will reach out and grab some of that over there. And so, and I know how many acres I need to set up in a certain area. And then I can select all the sales stands that I need to set up for that year. Some aren't ready. Some aren't quite, you know, for whatever reason, we're not going to set it up this year. So, you know, we can summarize all that at the beginning of the year and kind of go out and say, hey, Mike, you're going to set up timber sales in this area and I'll have this many acres of oak or northern hardwood and aspen. And the nice thing about being in longevity on a forest is you know it really well. So, I mean, it's super efficient. I've seen these acres. I kind of know the general area so I can hit the ground running. So that's kind of in a nutshell how a sale gets set up and why the boundaries look the way they look.
Yeah, that's super cool. It's probably been said before, but Forester might be the ruffed grouse's best friend. I don't think you would take all the credit, Mike, but you're definitely one of them, right?
Well, yeah, I think where the rubber hits the road is, you know, outside of a natural blowdown event, I think in terms of, you know, setting up the timber sale to create that habitat. And like I said, and then how do I make it as you know, the best quality habitat is kind of the next step, which is really as a career for me, as I'm getting further down my career chain, I think it's just been really, I've just sort of woken up to like, okay, we need to, what are these things that we can do a little bit better? And so it's been fun to kind of interact with the wildlife staff and kind of bring them in the conversation. And cause they're happy to be like, great, you're excited. We're excited. How do we work on this stuff together? And I, you know, we're doing a lot of cool things on our forest, breeding bird surveys and sharptail research and all these things that are focusing on wildlife. Cause I think as a large public landowner, it's our job to bring value to the public in ways, frankly, I didn't even know existed. And, you know, by doing these investments, we can tell a good story about what it is we're doing and why and the benefits it's providing.
So one other thing on forestry, specifically aspen cuts, and I think we mentioned it earlier, but like regenerating aspen stands, not all aspen stands regenerate equally. You know, they're not all the same. A 10-year-old cut in one spot doesn't look the same as a 10-year-old cut in another spot. And like the extent of my knowledge, I know that could vary on soil type. What other factors are at play? What causes one aspen stand to generate with a good level of stem density? And maybe describe to me what that is versus another one that is patchy, grassy, weedy. What's happening there?
Yep. No, great question. They do not. I'm learning as we go, too, in terms of, Jesus, this isn't coming back quite as well as I thought. I'd say a couple things. In the age of the current stand you're cutting, if it's over mature and starting to die back, you know, that clone, it's just a clone. So when we cut the trees, the root system is still alive, and they can sense that the overstory has been cut. And so for survival, they send out suckers. And so they're like, okay, survival mode, and they like full sunlight to successfully regenerate. So you remove all the overstory, the trees react with suckers, and you know, a good regeneration might be 5,000 to 8,000 stems per acre. I mean, super dense. And some areas are the aspen is just really old, and an old clone isn't going to regenerate nearly as vigorously as a 40-year-old clone of aspen. And then the other thing is, historically, you know, these forests are complex. It's not necessarily, you know, there's aspen stands that are pure aspen, but even within that, there's patches of oak, patches of red maple, patches of ironwood. And so even you could have a stand that didn't really have a lot of aspen to begin with. And so gotcha. You can't necessarily expect that whole 80 acres to be thick of full of aspen. It may be patchy because... And you may not know that, you know, hey, you'll come there in 10 years, shows up on Onyx Hunt and be like, what is this about? Like, it's patchy in here.
Yeah.
But, you know, me who set the sale up, it's like, well, there was one clone over there. It wasn't that big. And we're looking to regenerate oak, birch, and aspen. And aspen will be a component. Aspen will be patchy in here because that's what it was when we harvested the first time around. Mm-hmm. It could have been typed as an oak stand for all practical purposes, knowing that there was diversity of aspen pockets within it. So when it gets cut, it'll be patchy to aspen. So it really, you know, I know what the previous stand was because I set it up, and I fully expect to have patchiness going forward. And, you know, times of the year, I think, you know, if it's cut and it's a really wet time of the year that the logger's in there, and, you know, you don't want this to happen, but, you know, there could be some soil compaction. You try and minimize that through sale administration. But if there's on clay soils and it gets too wet and they're in there when they shouldn't be, that clone, you know, root, you know, soil compaction is a serious business, a serious problem, and the trees will suffer. Everything will suffer if that happens, and so you don't have good regeneration, the regeneration you would expect. And the other thing I would say is on some of these clay soils, there's a lot of nutrients in clay, but it's hard to actually pull it out. They're bound up so tight. Yeah. So and it's really wet or dry. It can be super saturated or bone dry, and so we have aspen clones that just do not look that good on clay soils. And based on the topography, I think what happens is they get really wet, super saturated, and then they get really, really dry. And it's just really hard on trees to kind of grow in that situation. And so when we're setting those timber sales up and we're getting, you know, fairly low volume per acre, it's like, boy, are these stands in decline or what's going on? And then you start looking at the historic harvest records and they basically cut the same amount of timber that we're cutting. And it's just sort of the nature of how clay can be. Those are some of the various ways that you see aspen come back in different levels. I think, you know, it's just the previous story of what you were dealing with tells a real, you know, insightful story about what's going to be in 10 years. And again, the hunter just shows up like, wow, what are the forestry department doing here? This doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, it doesn't always come back as well as you'd want. And natural regeneration is sort of a gamble sometimes. But an aspen sometimes is just going to be a component of the stand. It's not going to be everywhere thick 8,000 trees per acre. It might, you know, be more red maple over here, birch over there, and aspen over there.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. That's great insight. Cause I don't know that I probably hadn't considered all those factors, but yeah, it's, you know, as much as we love our maps and the forestry data is getting better and better, and you look at it and you, okay, I'm going to go in here and Onyx is telling me it's going to be an aspen stand, and you know, but it's never that clear cut, you know, in the real world, the natural world, there's so much diversity and variation that takes place. So that's where going in and exploring makes a lot of sense. But again, what was there to begin with? We don't know that. Yep. So, yeah, I will no longer walk in there and say, what the heck did Mike do in here?
Yeah, well, I say that sometimes too. I mean, regenerating trees and growing trees, it's just always, you know, recruitment.
That's not a perfect science, right?
No. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. The more I know, the less I know. But, you know, and so when you see patchy cuts, it'd be like, and it was a clear-cut prescription, it might be like, well, what are they doing clear-cutting this if it didn't really come back thick to aspen? But, well, you know, we're finding a lot of success in oak and, you know, red maple and birch all need a lot of light. And we're looking at regenerating a lot of those species through the even age / clear cut technique. And it's been quite successful based on a regeneration count. So, you know, all those species that are sort of in those, that bag of aspen are all, will benefit from a lot of sunlight and kind of open growing conditions. So they're all treated the same.
I think that aspen would be considered a resilient or hardy species, I mean, based on the way that it regenerates, but correct me if I'm wrong there. I'm just curious, like, is there anything that can come in and, outside of what we just talked about, is there anything that could come in and, like, totally, you know, stunt an aspen stand from regenerating? Or, like, what threats are there to regenerating aspen stands?
I would say we have seen some issues where really wet summer or fall, like if a sale gets cut during the summer and we get a lot of rain, and some of those clay soils can really pond up and hold at the very sensitive regeneration period we're getting, that I think it's just this really random window. Like, you're harvesting the stand every 50 years, and if it just happens to be really wet going into the fall, I think you can actually sort of swamp out some patches of a sale, and you get like a bull rush or whatever coming in. So I think just water table changes can be, but again, it's hard to predict any of that. And generally, I think that's a pretty minor component. But I do see where I think, boy, just the timing of the rain and just what the regeneration period is. I would say, you know, hypoxylin canker is a disease that hits. It's the largest killer of aspen, I think, in North America, and so it's just it's a fungal disease that kind of can get into these trees on stressed sites and actually lead to, you know, just dieback and small diameter growth and just stem density reduction. That's what we're seeing on some of these clay sites, where hypoxylin canker is always a component in some areas. I think where the trees are more stressed, you just see less density and more issues of just mortality from hypoxylin canker. And we have the forest tent caterpillar, which is just sort of we're overdue for the forest tent caterpillar.
Wait, it doesn't kill trees. Is that the army worm?
Yeah, AKA which we haven't had in a long time. It's usually on a 10-year...
Yeah, what's the deal with that? They used to say that was like every 7 years, but I haven't seen them in over a decade.
I think, you know, from what I've heard from the forest health folks, I think some of these wet springs is just, they don't handle that moisture in the spring well, and I think there's mortality. So I think a wet spring has prevented the population from building up. I'd say we're way overdue. I mean, it's been a long time since we have a mass, and I'm not looking forward to it, but I'm just,
I mean, for anybody that doesn't know about that, like, it's weird because that was like a big, I just remember that being kind of a big thing growing up. And like, I recall like being in high school or middle school, like in the middle of summer golfing at Lester Park Golf Course here in Duluth, and like, there's no leaves on the trees. I mean, they will literally, when there's a bad year, they come in and they take the green out of the woods, basically. It's unbelievable. And now, we haven't had them for a while. I can't imagine. Yeah. Were you there when there was any bad, like, outbreaks of them on in the county?
I was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, when I got here, it was like, just like you said, it's like late fall. I mean, there's like no green. It's just crazy. Yeah. And we've had sporadic outbreaks on the county forest in the last half a dozen years, but really spotty here and there. So that's a stress on the tree. I mean, it doesn't kill them. It can if it really hits them over and over. But I would say, yes, aspen is extremely resilient. I mean, it's an early successional, fire-adapted.
Yeah.
It comes in thick. It's a numbers game. So they're pretty tough. Yeah, those aspen are, and we're growing the aspen resource on the county forest just because it tends to, in the absence of getting oak back well, or it volunteers, it seeds in, it's a growing resource on the county forest.
Wow, very cool. Well, we're getting close to the end here. I do want to give you a chance to plug, at the very start of this conversation, we talked about Barron's Habitat, and we maybe mentioned Sharptail Grouse at that time. You're on the board of the Wisconsin Sharptail Grouse Society. They are one of those critical habitat species that use Barron's Habitat. Maybe just give us an update on what's going on in the world of Wisconsin Sharptail Grouse.
Yeah, happy to. There's sharptails on the Bayfield County Forest, which is really exciting. Pretty much all the sharptails, not quite all of them, but the sharptail range historically covered most of Wisconsin, and the last stronghold now is the Northwest Sands in Northwest Wisconsin. So there's various properties, state properties, Forest Service properties, and some county properties that are holding populations, but it's a general decline. I mean, it's sort of a few percent a year, just like a lot of bird species sort of in decline, and it's habitat related. And so we have birds in the county forest, and I've gotten pretty fired up about trying to make sure we keep them here and maybe help them grow a little bit. If we can turn the tide from -2% to +2%, I'd say that'd be a huge win. So we have barrens, current barrens, and it has birds on it, and we're creating another one to try and provide. What's happening is these birds are isolated, and the good habitat is too far away from each other, and so you get genetic inbreeding. And you have subpopulations that are pretty small. And when you have the small population, they're more vulnerable to, you know, a wet spring or predation. It's just, you know, you lose a couple of clutches and all of a sudden, you know, that local population can really struggle. And there's not just resiliency spread between the population. So we have scattered populations across the Northwest Sands. And some are more resilient and larger than others. The Nemecog and Barrens has quite a few birds on, which is great. Crex Meadows is starting to really, in the very southwest part of the Northwest Sands, has got a robust population that's growing. But we have a small population, and we're trying to figure out how we can best serve the needs of those sharptails within the parameters of a working forest. We're going to have most of the acreage is going to be working forest, but that doesn't mean we can't provide good habitat, Barron's Habitat. So the county started a research project with Natural Resources Research Institute out of University of Minnesota Duluth, avian ecology lab, to look at what are these birds doing on the landscape. And so by doing that, we are putting GPS backpacks on these sharptails, and we're trapping them in the spring. And we've trapped birds on adjacent properties, the Forest Service, and some industrial timberlands, and then our forest, to kind of see what is it the birds are doing. We don't know a lot about the sharptail use in forested conditions, small habitat size, and so it's applied research, I would say. How can that inform future management? How can we tweak the rolling barrens? How can we maximize the quality of the postage stamp that we have for them, because they're a critical part? And if we can keep sharptails, that's an umbrella species. There's a lot of plants and other wildlife species that, if you have sharptails, you have all these other species too. So that's sort of this keystone species. If you have sharptails, that means you have a lot of other important species too. So that's sort of the goal. If we have it's not all about sharptails. Yeah, it'd be great to have sharptails. It is, but we also want these other species too. So we talk a lot about sharptails, but that doesn't mean we don't care about all the other species underneath it. So it's been really exciting. Bayfield County, our department funded a lot of the research based on, you know, my advocacy and buy-in from the forestry committee and my boss to say, hey, yeah, we have these birds. What are they doing? We don't know much about them. And it's really been great to see, you know, with these GPS backpacks that transmit a point every 4 hours, how they're using the landscape. And so we're in the early stages. We're in the second year, you know, the technology of, you know, longevity of the backpacks and, you know, how, you know, a couple of packs have fallen off the birds. And but we have five on air now, and I'm really hoping we can get these collars to stay going throughout the winter. Just how are they moving through the winter? What's habitat changes? It'd be great to see what dispersal rates look like. Those young of the year, you know, they tend to move, and you know how to. And unfortunately, we didn't capture any females. I mean, obviously, the most important bird to get would be the female, and we tried and we tried and we tried, and we ended up getting males. But the males will tell us some stuff too, and this is an ongoing project. But yeah, we're trying to develop a baseline data. What are sharptails doing in the forested condition, especially on the Bayfield County Forest? and what can we learn and how can we help that population? And the Wisconsin Sharp-Tailed Grouse Society has helped us fund some of the collars, and there's just been a lot of general support. And I think a lot of excitement from the wildlife staff at the DNR and even the research folks. They've never collared any sharp tails before, and so I think we're all sort of excited to see how we can help these birds. And we're doing active management in the core, and we're opening up our core property. Even right now, I flew the drone out there, and there's a timber sale in there, and so we're giving a more available habitat. And it's just really neat when you have birds with GPS backpacks on and you're opening up habitat within their home range. It'll be interesting to see how those birds are moving across the landscape now that those trees have been removed, like today, yeah. You know, and we can get that data tomorrow. And, you know, we're hoping yeah. as they move into the adjacent rolling forest, the rolling barrens, how we can make that rolling barrens the most effective it can be for these birds based on actual real-time data that these birds are giving us. So I really hope it's a long-term project, and that research isn't done, you know, in a vacuum. That's going to inform our management all the time. And so that's an exciting thing to be a part of.
Yeah, definitely something that I've shared from time to time on the podcast. Again, there's no hunting season. There used to be a hunting season on Wisconsin sharptails. At this point, they're non-huntable species, but obviously there's a lot of folks invested in and just have a passion for the bird and an interest in the bird and the habitat and all of the other species that utilize that habitat, as you mentioned. But it's cool, the close proximity of it. And again, it's maybe there's something to it. Just it's not necessarily the first bird you think of when you think of northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin, but they're kind of a star in that way, I think.
Yeah, and we're trying to get the word out to social media. I think there's a cool story there. And you know, Nick, you and I have hunted them out in North Dakota, and
yep.
And it's great to see them as a huntable population. And I mean, I'm all for trying to get a huntable population here. First and foremost, we got to just work on turning the tide. And a great success story would be to have a limited harvest here. I don't think we're quite there yet. Yeah. But yeah, just being able to, you know, go hunt them, it's really got me fired up to try and do what I can to make sure they stay here too. And I just don't think a lot of people are aware of it. And it's, boy, if you can watch them dance on a lek in the spring, it will change your life. It's just a special thing to see those little birds do their dance. It's really neat. And to see it in the county I work in, it's just extra special. That's the forest I'm helping manage. Yeah. I'm trying to help these birds do what I can. And then to watch those little guys dance and try and entice the hens in. It's just, I don't know. It's a great, I mean, I can go on and on about how great my job is, but you know, those are the kind of things that, you know, really fire me up to kind of keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, it is abundantly clear that you've got a passion for the natural landscape that you work in and the wildlife that inhabit it. And I know it gets me fired up and it inspires me a lot. And a lot of the tidbits I've probably shared over the years about grouse hunting and forestry, Mike, you've had a pretty big influence on me in that regard. So I appreciate that. I know the listeners do. Thank you for taking some time to join us on the Birdshot Podcast. This was a blast, man. I will look forward to your next appearance on the show, and until then probably get some hunting in.
Yeah, absolutely, looking forward to the fall.
All right, buddy. Wisconsin Sharptails website,
Wisconsin, we're just revamping it, so okay. Folks chime in. We're on Instagram, I think, with WI Sharptails.
Yeah, I'll link that up.
Yep, Wisconsin Sharptail Grouse Society.org, I think is what it is. But we got some new designs, some merchandise, trying to get some momentum for these birds and habitats. So, yeah, it's an exciting time for sharptails in a lot of different ways.
Got it. Good deal, man. Thanks again for taking the time, and appreciate you coming on the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast, presented by Onyx Hunt and Final Rise. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, like, and share, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own
Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.